This conference will.
Welcome, everybody. This is Rochelle, the Right Now Coach, and you're at the Right Now Mastermind class for May 2013. Our guest is Donna Gebhardt, and she's talking about writing for the middle grade market. Let me tell you a little bit about Donna. Donna's first novel, As If Being 12 and 3 Quarters Isn't Bad Enough, My Mother is Running for President, won the prestigious Sid Fleischman Humor Award. Her second novel, How to Survive Middle School, received star reviews from Kirkus and School Library Journal and landed on these state reading lists, Texas, New York, Illinois, and Louisiana. Donna's new book, Olivia Bean, Trivia Queen, about a girl determined to get on the TV quiz show Jeopardy!, received a star review from Kirkus and an endorsement from Jeopardy! Champ Ken Jennings. In addition to writing books for children, Donna has written for the following publications: Family Circle Magazine, the Los Angeles Times Newspaper, Parenting Highlights for Children, Scholastic Storyworks Magazine, and many others. Visit Donna online at donnagebhardt.com. And if you want to enter to win a copy of Olivia Bean Trivia Queen, you can go to my website, rightnowcoach.com/blog, find Donna's post from last week, and, you know, it tells you how to enter the contest there, and you get points for coming today. So welcome. Welcome, Donna. We're glad to have you here.
Hi, Rochelle. Hi, everybody. Great to be here.
And I'm hearing a little interference, so if anybody, like, I don't know, if you got drama at your house, I always have drama, *6 will mute yourself. *7 will unmute yourself. So go ahead and mute yourself. We're going to set some time to unmute yourself and ask questions at the end. So Donna, glad to have you here. You've got so many amazing credits, but let's go back to the beginning. How did you get started writing?
Oh, gosh, that's all the way back to when I was about 10 years old.
Okay.
Well, even farther back, really, I started writing because my mom used to take me to the Northeast Regional Library in Philadelphia, and I started to love books. And then when I was about 10 years old, I was bored out of my skull. I didn't know what to do with myself. We had no computers back then. TV was lousy if the Brady Bunch wasn't on. So I grabbed a piece of paper and a pen, and I wrote a short story about a horse. I'd never seen a horse before, but I wrote a short story about a horse. And I showed it to my mom, and my mom was always working and always busy, and she just paid so much attention to this story and to me that I decided when I was about 10 that I'd become a writer. So it all started when I was 10.
Oh, that's great. And then how did you move to kind of writing professionally? How did that piece of your life start?
Right. Well, first of all, there were lots of stumbles along the way, of course. I started submitting when I was 14, I bought a used typewriter, and I typed up greeting card ideas, and I sent them to Hallmark. So I am proud to say that my very first of hundreds of rejection letters came from Hallmark greeting cards. I really took a very weird path. I didn't actually start out in writing. I did a whole bunch of jobs just to pay the bills. And then eventually, I did start selling greeting cards, and I was hired by one of the companies that bought my cards to work full-time as an editor for a greeting card company. So I started there. And then about 7 years later, I left to raise my children and just do freelance work. So little by little, I built up from greeting cards, magazine articles, to stories for children, then eventually, and I mean eventually, books.
And talk a little bit about this desire to write for children. Where did this come from? What made you really want to enter this market?
I think I'm just, 12 years old at heart, but I really don't know where it came from. You know, I've written for every age group, you know, all the way up through adult, and it's just where I feel most comfortable. It's where my voice is most natural. I really remember being about 12 years old and the different things that happened. I don't know if that has anything to do with it. And I just love writing for this age group, and I love going to schools and meeting the kids of this age group, and it just feels really comfortable for me.
That's really great. And let's, you know, you're talking about this age group, and I think maybe not everybody understands what this age group is. And if you're just joining us, our guest is Donna Gebhardt. We're talking about writing for the middle grade market. If you'd like to mute yourself, press *6. If you'd like to unmute yourself at the end of the call to ask questions, you'll push *7. So talk a little bit about the difference between middle grade and young adult, and what, how do we understand that in terms of ages and reading levels and so forth?
Absolutely. There is a difference between middle grade and young adult, and the easiest way to think about it if you're writing is think about the age of your protagonist in your book. My protagonists tend to be about 11 or 12 years old. But the other thing to think about is even though your protagonist might be 12 years old, your reader can be as young as 8 years old. I have done so many events where I'm actually shocked to have, you know, third graders come up to me and tell me that they love my books. So it's important to be careful about the themes that we're writing about, and the themes that you would write for young adults naturally are different than what you would write about for middle grade, or at least treat it differently. I mean, you can talk about really heavy topics, obviously, like death or illness, but you would just treat it a little bit differently for middle grade, being aware that your reader could be as young as 8 or 9 years old.
Wow. And is there a length difference between middle grade and young adult, or do they tend to just vary depending on topic or story?
It does tend to depend on the story, because we've seen very, very short young adult novels, some written in verse, and we've seen very long middle grade novels. So I think it depends on, you know, what's necessary for your story. And I did want to mention one of the things I love about writing for middle grade is that is a time that is perfect for drama. It is ripe for drama because, you know, that's when children are changing physically, they're changing emotionally, they're going through puberty, which is, you know, a roller coaster of drama. So they're learning how to bridge that chasm from childhood to adulthood. So it's, for me, it's just a great age to write for. And I think those kids are so hungry for a roadmap on how to grow up. So they just devour, you know, fiction for that age group. So I enjoy it so much.
Oh, that's cool. That's great. Well, one of the ways I think I learn best about writing is by reading. So maybe you could talk a little bit about what are your favorite middle grade titles? What are things that you'd recommend? If we want to write for middle grade audience, what should we be reading? Who, what authors, what titles?
Okay, terrific. No problem. Well, and this is, I have to emphasize that this is a partial list, because I could spend the entire hour, you know, recommending authors and titles. So this is a partial list to get you going. Some of the authors that I love are Jennifer Cholbenko, Christopher Paul Curtis, Gary Schmidt, Richard Peck, Jack Gantos, Lewis Sacker. I know he won the Newbery for Holes, but he wrote a lot of terrific middle grade books before Holes ever came out. They're great to read. Some of the books that I really enjoy for middle grade, A Crooked Kind of Perfect by Linda Urban, Freak the Mighty by Rodman Philbrick. He has many, many great middle grade titles. How about Ringer by Jerry Spinelli? I know not the one he won the Newbery Medal for, but wonderful book. And we'll go in the Wayback Machine. I love 100 Dresses by Eleanor Estes. As a child, I so related to the poverty, you know, of the main character and the feeling of isolation. I still love that book. One of my favorite books is Bridge to Terabithia by Catherine Pearson. Talk about putting a heavy topic in a novel for middle grade. And I love the spirited, strong-willed girl in Ella Enchanted by Gail Carson Levine.
That's great. And I think I'm going to have you email me that list so I can email it to everybody who came. So I'll be sending, when I send out the link to the recording, I'll send you a link to Donna's website and my website where you can enter the contest and this list. Now, where do you have a sense of like where we can go if we want to like get a hold of reads for this age group?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, just like the list is a partial list, this is a partial list as well. First of all, your public library, they often do lists of great mysteries for middle grades, great humor books for middle grades. So your library is a good place to start. There's a website called From the Mixed Up Files. It's all one word, From the Mixed Up Files. It's everything about middle grade literature, from the new titles that come out every month, to indie bookstores that sell middle grade titles. I love that website. You might also want to look on the Children's Book Council website, cbcbooks.org. Indiebound.org is the independent bookseller website. You'll find lots of great recommendations there. Oprah has a kids reading list. and fantastic recommendations from there. And then the ALA.org, where you'll get the Newbery lists and all the meta lists, and that's always a great place to begin.
Oh, those are great. So we've been talking about books to read, but certainly there are books on craft, too. So as someone who writes for this market, do you have a sense of what books on craft are helpful for those of us who want to write for the middle grade market?
Yes, I think I own them all. My husband just says that the shelf in my closet is going to collapse one day because I have so many books on craft. Because I always loved reading books on craft, and I always want to know how does somebody else do it. So the one thing I will recommend is every year I get the Children's Writers and Illustrators Market, CWIM, from Writer's Digest. And the reason I like that is because the front matter is all full of articles on craft, and they're really up to date and they're spot on. And then, of course, you have all the markets to send your work. And here are a few others that I really like. Story by Robert McKee, even though it's really for playwrights, it is that book where I finally learned how to structure a novel. Story by Robert McKee. And then if you want the nuts and bolts of writing for children, there's a book called You Can Write Children's Books by Tracy Dills, D-I-L-S. And she has a book about how to write for children, and then there's a workbook where you're actually going to be writing the books. And I thought they were wonderful, the You Can Write Children's Books. And then for a different perspective, a book that I read years ago and still stays with me, it's called Dear Genius, The Letters of Ursula Nordstrom by Leonard Marcus. And there you find, you know, somebody who is absolutely a legendary editor in the field working with just the top children's writers and illustrators in the field, and their personal correspondence between each other. It was so enlightening. I love that book.
Oh, me too. I get like goosebumps when I read it because she's writing to all these authors of the books I loved when I was a kid, the books my mom loved when she was a kid. And so,
yeah, and one of the things that she said that stuck with me through all the years was, other people can clean your house or mow your lawn, but nobody can write the books that you can write. Spend your time writing. I just love that. And of course, I hired somebody to do the lawn and clean the house after that. But a couple other good books are, this one's, it's at least a decade old, but I still think it's very relevant. It's called It's a Bunny Eat Bunny World, A Writer's Guide to Surviving and Thriving in Today's Competitive Children's Book Market. And that's by Olga Litowinski. And then the last one I'll recommend is called Seize the Story by Victoria Hanley. And the reason I like that one is she has a lot of interviews with authors in her book, and I always like that.
Oh, that's great. Well, thank you. And I'm going to get these lists from you, from Donna, everyone, and I'll make sure you get them when I send out the link to the recording. Donna, let's turn to your writing and talk a little bit about your process for writing. What does it look like?
It's very ugly. I think it's good to share this process because it is truly crazy making. It takes me, I can't even say how long, sometimes months, sometimes years, to come up with an idea that has the weight to carry a whole novel. And this is how I do it. I'm very open to everything I hear, see, read about, and I say, oh, that would be a great idea. And I write it down. And then I'll write about a chapter or two and then get completely stuck and say, you know, it wasn't such a great idea after all. And then I'll decide I have to get a job in another field digging ditches or something, and then my agent talks me down from the ledge. And this happens repeatedly. Or sometimes I send her the not-so-good versions of a book, and she very nicely lets me know that they will not be working. But eventually, I find something that I really think will work, that I can sustain for a whole novel, and as fast as I can, I get that first draft out there, and then I work for months revising, and it's only in the last book or two that I've started to use some semblance of outlines. It's requested now. You know, I'm supposed to do just a couple chapters and an outline now to sell my books now that I'm at the position I'm in, and I resisted it, but it's very helpful because I have found that when I do the outline ahead of time, I find the problems in my plot before I'm 50, 60, 100 pages in.
Mm.
And that, yeah, it's wonderful. And that roadmap of the outline can really carry me through a whole book. So I've learned to not dislike outlines so much.
And talk about research. Do you do a lot of research? I mean, did you watch like 7,000 hours of Jeopardy?
And who wouldn't want to do that? I love
right.
Some of the fun things that I do and call research, it's really, can't even call this a job. But what I like to do is I ignore the axiom, write what you know.
Mm-hmm.
I write what I know emotionally. I write truthfully emotionally, but I always challenge myself with subject matter that I don't know. In my first book I wrote about spelling bees, the characters of spelling bee champ, and a parent who's running for president. I had to do tons and tons of research. I interviewed somebody who went through the chain of spelling bees and ended up in D.C. I got tons of books and websites. So that one just took a ton of research. And then, of course, for my next book, How to Survive Middle School, it involves Jon Stewart from The Daily Show. So that was kind of fun, watching Daily Show episodes. And then I had to learn what happens if you become a YouTube phenom. So I did all kinds of research there. I went into a school's TV news studio, and I had one of the students give me a tour because that's part of the book. So I'm always challenging myself by writing about things I don't know about. The Jeopardy book, Olivia Dean, was so much fun to write because I was literally surrounded by dozens of trivia books looking for the grossest, weirdest, funniest bits of trivia, and then books by former Jeopardy champs about what it was like to be on the show. It was really a lot of fun. And my brand new book that's coming out next year is called Death by Toilet Paper. And unfortunately or fortunately, I know more toilet paper facts than any normal human being should.
And I bet you know a lot of toilet paper jokes, too.
Yeah. Sadly, I do.
Yes, I have an 11-year-old in my house and a teenage son, and so we spend a lot of our time talking about jokes, potty humor jokes. When we're not looking at fashion, we're talking about potty humor, which is great. Well, I'm curious about kind of that movement from writing to publication, and it's such a crowded field. I guess my first question has to do with how does a writer stand out in the crowded field in terms of getting published, and then I want to talk a little bit about publicity. So how did you do it? How can we kind of position ourselves so that our books get the attention of an agent or an editor or whatever?
Okay, now that certainly is a tough question, because what we tend to want to do with those things is try to guess what's going to be popular, try to chase the trends, and that's probably the worst thing you can do, because everybody else is doing that, and the agents and editors are getting flooded with those things. What you need to do is pull what is unique from your experience, from your life, from your emotions, and when you tap into those things that are so deeply personal, you will somehow tap into the universal feelings of others. And it's a YA book, but I'm thinking of the newer book called Eleanor and Park. And that book is so popular and it's so well-loved because it gets so deeply into the hearts and minds of the character. That's what we all want in a good book. We want to be pulled completely into the heart and mind of the character that will follow them anywhere. You know, it's a really fun adventure. Don't write what you think someone else would like. Write what you would like. Write what you would have loved as a kid. Fascinate yourself. Seek answers to questions that pique your curiosity. Like R.J. Palacio, I don't know how to pronounce her name, Wonder. She asked the question in Wonder, what would it be like for a child to live with a facial deformity? And from that one question that wouldn't leave her alone, she came up with this fantastic, you know, best-selling book. So really the answer is not to look outside of you. It's to go deep within you.
That's a wonderful advice. And then once we've looked deep within us and we've got our manuscript and we've polished it and so forth, how do we move to the next step of connecting with agents or editors? What are some things we can do to up our chances?
Well, you know, I wish that there were some magic or answer that I could provide for this. And I will only tell you that I have 6 completed revised novels that I sent out and hoped about and were rejected. So there is no quick or easy path. But if your novel is the best it could absolutely be, if maybe you went through several rounds with your critique group, then, you know, come up with the best query letter you can for it and just start subbing agents. You don't have to know anybody. You don't have to have an in. They're open. They're looking for that next novel that captures them. And certainly if you're able to go to conferences and meet agents and editors personally or to have your work submitted at conferences, that's also a really terrific way these days to stand out a little bit and get in.
That's great. So talk about the middle grade market. What's it like? I mean, I think one of the things I've been writing a lot about on my blog is just how discouraging things feel right now with all the indie publishing. And I just want to say once again, I'm getting a little bit of feedback. So if you think it might be you, if you're not muted, go ahead and push *6 and mute yourself. And I'll tell you how to unmute yourself when we get time for a little bit later for questions. So *6 to mute yourself. So I think it can be kind of discouraging. The market's just flooded. I get probably over 100 requests a week for people wanting me to review their books, mostly self-published. What's the middle grade market like these days? And maybe you can even talk about that indie publishing versus traditional there.
Right, indie versus traditional. Let's start with the middle grade market because there's really good news there and that makes me happy to share with everybody. For years, I was writing middle grade fiction, primarily humorous, often aimed at boys, because that's what I write, because that's what I'm good at writing and that's what feels natural. And for years, the only thing that I was hearing was, YA market is hot, the young adult market is so hot, fantasy's where it's at. You know, and of course before J.K. Rowling came along with Harry Potter, you couldn't sell fantasy if your life depended on it. So everything ebbs and flows. So for years it was YA and it was fantasy. But now we're hearing that contemporary middle grade is hot, especially humor and especially boys, for boys. Hooray! In Publishers Marketplace and Publishers Weekly, now the deals that we're reading about are for middle grade fiction. And that's making me very happy because I think there was, you know, a hole in that area for a long time. I was even hearing for foreign rights, they just weren't buying middle grade. It was all young adult. And it's all flipping on its head. And middle grade is very much sought after now. So if that's what you write, this is the best news you could hear. Okay, so you asked me about indie versus traditional publishing.
Yeah.
And I think that some people have been very successful with indie publishing. And I'm thinking particularly of, there's a website called The Bookshelf Muse, all one word. They built a fantastic platform. They have well over 3,000 subscribers. And they came out with a book called The Emotion Thesaurus, which is basically different ways to describe your character's emotions without using the same old tired ways we often do. And it became a bestseller. It's just taken off. It's doing phenomenally well. But those two women who create that site and that book did everything right. They built their platform. They gave tons and tons of information through their blog. Their book was solid. It was professionally edited. The cover was professionally done. They did everything right. So, I mean, I think there is definitely a path through indie publishing if you're willing to do the work and have everything, all the pieces that a traditional publisher would do if you're willing to pay to have them done. I think you can succeed. The hard part is the promotion and the marketing and the channels to get your book out in people's hands. that's the hard part even for traditional publishers. So it's really a big job, and if you feel like you're up for that job, I would encourage you to do it. Otherwise, I like traditional publishing because you know the books are going to be, for the most part, exceptionally well edited. There's so many levels to that process before a book is published that I think it elevates the quality of the books that we're reading, and I like that. So that's my two cents on that.
That's great. And now, you know, you mentioned promotion, and that's kind of, I mean, writers have always had to promote. I think it's just more prevalent these days. And so what do you think are effective ways to promote a middle grade book?
Okay. As far as promotion, the one thing I just want everybody to keep in mind is sometimes you can work incredibly hard at promoting your book. You can do everything imaginable, and your book still won't make that big of a splash. In fact, most books that are published, including my own, just come out, and they just don't make that much of a splash. There's so many available. That's just the way it works. Or you can do very little, and the book can have a huge impact. For my first book, As If Being 12 and 3 Quarters Isn't Bad Enough, My Mother's Running for President, I don't know why I have such a long title. For the first book, the publisher did tons of promotion. They flew me to different conferences. They gave out promotion at shopping malls. And the book did okay. It took me years and years to earn out my advance. For my second book, How to Survive Middle School, there was very little promotion done. Review copies went out, and I had a video made. That's it. The book took off like crazy. I earned out my advance in months. It went back for multiple printings. It sold over 200,000 copies in the Scholastic Book Fairs. I did almost nothing to make that happen. So I just think that's really important to understand right up front. And the bottom line, before I go into what you can do to promote your book, the bottom line is the most important thing you can do and the thing you have control over doing is write the next book. But as far as if you want to promote your book, you absolutely have to have a basic website where people can find information about you and your book and contact you. You should have some other kind of online presence, but my advice is to do what's comfortable. I do Facebook. I'm not on Twitter yet. I know there's Tumblr. There's so many different options, you know, Instagram, et cetera, et cetera. Do what feels comfortable. My whole philosophy with promoting is giving, like school visits, site visits. I speak at conferences to try to share information. I write articles for magazines. Those are the kind of things that I do. I try to just think in terms of what can I give, not what I can get, and that actually works really well.
That's great. And have you done any of the kind of more expensive things like hiring someone to help you promote your book, or do you mostly do it all on your own?
I'm very fortunate with Random House that there is a publicist in-house. The person, of course, is overworked and probably underpaid, but and I'm one of many, many books on the list. So they do some things, and then I try to supplement. I haven't done anything too expensive. I do some basic things. I get reading guides for teachers and librarians available free on my website. I pay to have those created. I have paid to have videos of my books, professional videos made. And the thing that I find most useful is I have bookmarks made. My niece is a graphic designer, and she helped me with the artwork. And so it's so easy when I go to schools or events, I can give out bookmarks, or if I do a Skype visit, I can send the children signed bookmarks when I'm finished. So small things that are not big investments are what I found to be useful for me.
Yeah, that's great. So I'm curious about the school visit thing and, librarians and teachers, and I guess I'm curious about a couple things. You know, first of all, how do we reach librarians and teachers, and then how do you kind of juggle the for fee and free piece of that? How much do you do for nothing, and how much do you charge for?
That's a great question. As far as reaching librarians and teachers, start small. Start with your local school. Introduce yourself to the librarian. If you have children and you can introduce yourself to their teachers, that's a great thing. That's what I did. I just started small. I went up to my kids' librarian and let them know I had a new book out. And believe it or not, from those small things, like that one particular librarian ended up being on a committee for our state reading association and knew me, so invited me to speak, and I ended up speaking to all the librarians in Florida. So, I mean, those small connections, you don't know what they will blossom into. So I always say, you know, start small. And then the other thing is to offer things to help them. Teachers and librarians in schools are so overworked and overwhelmed, so anything you could do to help, like I already mentioned, I have the reading and activity guides, which is an easy thing to email them, and then they can use it with their students. I do Skype visits. I do some for free, and some I charge for, and I can talk about that in a minute. I try to give out resources for educators. Whenever I find something great that I think will help teachers, I've built up a list of teachers that have contacted me, and I'll share that with them. Like, for example, Kate Mesner, who is a wonderful middle grade author. In the summer, she does a program for teachers who like to write, and it's basically a free online writing workshop. Well, I'm going to send that information out to all the teachers that I know, just to, you know, to anything to help them and make it easier for them. Now, as far as the free versus fee, I think it's really important that we value our time. This is our work. We wouldn't ask like a plumber to come to our house and not pay them. So this is our work. And if we're going to do a school visit, maybe the first one or two we'll do locally. Maybe we won't charge anything till we feel like we're very good at it and we get comfortable. But then I think it's really important to charge for our work. I don't think people value what they pay for, and you wouldn't be able to make a living if you didn't charge for these things. And they take school visits take a tremendous amount of time and energy. Even Skype visits take a lot of time and energy. So what I do is I offer very short Skype visits for free on a limited basis, and then if they want a longer, more involved Skype visit, then I charge a fee for that.
And can you tell us a little bit about what a school visit would look like typically? Are you with smaller classes teaching writing, or are you with like a big assembly of students, like doing your shtick, or how does this work?
Right. Well, it can go any number of ways. And you can really, you know, guide what you want to do, especially when you start out. And I've done all those things. But what I tend to do now when I do school visits is I speak to large groups. So, for example, I will speak to an entire fifth grade of the school in the auditorium or in the cafetorium, depending on where we are. And I'll do that for about 45 minutes. And I'll probably do about two of those presentations in the morning, and then maybe I'll give a writing workshop to a smaller group, and then I will sign books and meet the kids. That's what a typical school visit looks like. Of course, you could just go in and do writing workshops. You could just go in and speak to one or two classes. I mean, you can modify it for whatever works, but if I'm going to be in a school, I like to speak to the maximum number of kids possible. And then if there's a chance to meet them personally afterwards, I'll do that too. I'll stay as long and I'll sign as many books or whatever I can do to be helpful at that point.
And how you know, going back to the age level, I think it sounds like you're mostly with upper elementary kids. What kind, do you go to middle schools as well, or do you tend to hang with the fourth and fifth graders?
I do a lot of work at middle schools, which I know terrifies some people, but it doesn't bother me at all. I don't know why. And I often do upper elementary, third, fourth, fifth grade. But the thing that scares me is to speak to a group of kindergartners because you just don't know what they're going to do. I remember last time I did an elementary school visit, and they wanted me to speak to all ages, first the older kids and then the younger kids. And this little kid just came up and was showing me a boo-boo that she got. And then all the kids were showing me their Band-Aids and their boo-boos. You never know what you're going to get with them. So, you know, throw me in with 500 middle school kids, and I can talk to them with no problem. Put me in front of like 50 kindergartners, and I start sweating.
That is so absolutely true and so hilarious. I love it. So I'm going to open it up in a minute for questions, but I want to go back to kind of the beginning. If we want to begin to write for kids, what or for middle grade audiences, where are some starting points for us to look for ideas or start working on this writing? Are there, I guess just start with that. Are there things that you recommend writers do to begin for this level?
To look for ideas for writing for the middle grade market?
Yeah, and then to start the writing.
Okay, well, I think the thing that you need to do, which will probably require you to pay for therapy, go back to your memories of middle school. Back then it was called junior high when I went. Go back to your memories then. Remember the first time this or that happened. Remember the most horrible, most embarrassing thing that happened to you or that happened to a friend. I mean, you will be dredging the worst of the worst memories. And from that, somehow humor comes. Because when I did my How to Survive Middle School book, I was inspired because our son, who was in middle school at the time, was having a horrible time. He's in high school now, and he's fine. But then I remembered when I was in middle school, and I had acne, and I had braces, and I was in love with a guy who didn't even know I existed. And I remembered all those things, and I just tapped into that. And then somehow from that, the humor grew. So basically tapping into our most horrible memories of that time. And I think you can also read books about child development. And I think that's really useful because then you can see what matters to kids at that time, what they're going through, what's important to them, even what their brain development is like, and then your writing.
That's great. And then if we wanted to write shorter pieces, are there some venues that you found that welcome short stories or poems or nonfiction for middle graders?
To be honest, I have found that those markets have shrunk consistently through the years. I think occasionally there's collections of short stories, like you think of John Cheska's Guys Read book. Mm-hmm. So occasionally there's collections of short stories, but, you know, hard to get into and hard to find. There are still magazines, you know, that are accepting stories and nonfiction, but again, harder to get into. The markets are shrinking. So, I mean, I wish there was better news in that area, and I wish I could direct you to a specific market. But the best bet is to look at the children's writers and illustrators market and see which publications are still seeking those kind of things. I know Highlights is still looking, and they're wonderful magazines.
That's great. That's helpful. And you had great news about the book market earlier, so it's okay. You don't have to feel bad.
It can't all be good news.
It can't all be good, no. And so we're at the time where I can open it up to our callers. If you want to ask a question, just unmute yourself by pushing *7, and feel free to ask Donna a question from your own kind of concerns and experience. So anybody who has a question, this is the time. You can unmute yourself by pushing *7, and then if you need to remute yourself, you push *6. So who's got a question?
Donna, I have a quick question. My name is Jamie Engel, and I am actually publishing my first middle grade novel this September. It's being released. And I had some questions, I guess, about publicity for the book. And I was going to host a local kind of party event, like kid-friendly party event, invite other local authors to sell books as well and bring in a charity organization to donate. Do you think, I mean, it's going to be like a mini wedding. Do you think that would be a successful way to invest money to publish or to promote the book, or should I just sit back and just kind of put it out there and just see where it goes?
Well, first of all, Jamie, congratulations. I've seen you on Facebook, and I think that's just wonderful. I mean, that's just a huge step right there. And it's great that you want to promote your work and get it out there. So first thing is publication party. So like I said, lots of times a book comes out, and it's the big day, and nothing really happens. So to have at least a publication party, I think, is a fantastic idea. What I did when my first book came out, or I should say some friends did for me, is it was some family and some friends. We met for lunch. We celebrated. We went across the street to the bookstore and saw the book on the shelves for the first time. It was really wonderful. But I love the way you want to incorporate other local authors, you know, to sell their books. But that's a big endeavor. So just think really carefully about it before you do it. I think it's a wonderful idea, but you have to make sure that the other authors would be available, that they would be willing to do it. I know with certain companies, like with Random House, we're not allowed to purchase and sell our own books. It must be done through a bookseller. So, I mean, there's certain things just to keep in mind if you're going to enlarge it to that scale. But one way or another, if you have finally got to the point where you're having a book come out, I think it's fantastic to find some way to celebrate.
Thank you.
Oh, thanks.
Thanks, Jamie, and congratulations. That's exciting.
Thank you. Thank you.
Are there questions?
Hi, Donna. This is Susan Korchak. I loved Olivia being Trivia Queen, and I also read your article in the most recent issue of the SCBWI magazine and your recommendations on TED Talks, which were terrific.
Oh, thank you.
My question is, in writing Olivia, you put Mom out of the picture for a while. And that gives Olivia a chance to really figure out things on her own. I wondered if you knew in advance how long you were going to put Mom off stage, or if that, how you decided kind of what, you know, how many chapters you were going to leave her off and have Olivia hanging a little bit by herself.
Right. Oh, thanks for the question, Susan. You know, it's a terrible thing that we authors do to the parents of our characters. In fact, I pretty much have at least one parent in every one of my books, either deceased or out of the picture in one way or another. And I promised my editor that in my next book, I would have, in my fifth book, I would have an intact family, but I don't know if I'll be able to do it because there needs to be an emotional heart and core of the story. So I read one time that basically every single plot is a character coming up against obstacles to receiving love. And, I mean, who better to provide love than the parents? So I guess it's kind of lazy on my part, but I do usually have some sort of obstacle to love with one of the parents, or, like you said, getting a parent out of the way a little while so that the main character has to solve the problem herself, is on her own. I didn't plan it out ahead of time other than to know that she would have some kind of struggle, and sometimes it's just more convenient. when the parents step aside, you just have to make sure it feels organic and realistic when the parents are out of the picture. And not dangerous, especially for middle grade. So it's like walking a tightrope. You have to decide what works best for your story as far as when the parents will be there to help and when they won't.
That's really helpful. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
And great question, Susan. Other people have questions? Either about the writing process or the publishing process or publicity.
Or my pets. If people want to know about my pets, I'm happy to talk about
okay,
them.
Okay, there you go. My pets are being so good. I gave them treats and put them in my office here so that they, because usually this is about the time the mailman comes, so they're at the window barking like crazy. So.
I know. I had to drug my dog. No, I'm just kidding. I did not do that.
You'll drug the parents in your next story. That's what you're going to do. Other questions?
I'll jump in here. This is Lori Norman. Donna, hi.
Hi, Lori.
Hi. Just a comment to say that I really am holding on to what you just said about challenging yourself to get into areas that you don't know, rather than the advice that we've heard for years. You know, write what you know. One of the middle grade novel that I'm working on, the girl ends up becoming very ill, and with a disease that I knew nothing about, I just witnessed it when I was a child myself. And it really got me so scared as I did the research and I talked to people and everything. I just felt like I was in a realm where I just don't have any expertise, and it was you know, either change the challenge that she's going to face or give up on this book. Although I don't want to because I've put so much into it already. And I think it's just a question of being afraid of going where I don't know and trusting that I can do research and find out and understand. And I mean, I've had fun doing the research. I've talked to paramedics at the fire station across the street and people who have experienced this disease. And but it is it's scary, and it almost stops me in my tracks. So I'm just holding on to what you said about challenging yourself. And I guess the thing that I wanted to ask about was book signings. I just feel like that's such a scary thing. I mean, I'm not at that point yet because I don't have any book accepted, but it just scares me to think of sitting in a bookstore or someplace and waiting and hoping that somebody will come by. Do you find book signings of any value at all at that kind of a venue?
Lori, thank you for actually both questions, because I'm going to address both things that you talked about. And first, I want to talk about your character facing an incredible challenge in your book. Mm-hmm. Now, first of all, everybody listening, you can do the research. You can find out anything. So don't worry about having expertise. You can make yourself an expert on whatever you need to. That's not the problem. What happens is we fall in love with our characters, as we should, and it is very, very hard for us to make our characters go through difficult things. It's heartbreaking as an author, and you have to go through it again and again because you revise and you revise, and every time those emotions are raw and new, and yet those challenging things that we put our characters through are the things that make our books the very best. The hardest scenes in the books are the ones that your young readers will remember the most. Sorry to have a spoiler here, but in How to Survive Middle School, when my character is at his very lowest, his only friend in the world, his pet hamster, dies. You know, I had to do some research to find out the truth about that, but it was a horrible and hard scene to write because it was breaking my heart, and yet the majority of the mail that I get from young readers is about that scene. It's the one that affected them the most. And in essence, it's the one that will help them the most, because our young readers are going to go through hard things in their lives. And if they can sort of practice it through a book first, it gives them some tools to deal with. So anyway, so I think it's really important to dive into those challenges, and even though we're afraid of them, to be brave and have courage and do it anyway. Now, on to book signings. Yes, book signings are scary things. I do them as little as possible because I read a statistic, and I think it's true. At the average book signing, an author will sell 3 books.
Mm-hmm.
That's average, so some people will sell fewer than 3. The couple book signings that I have done, I've done with a buddy. So they have a book out, I have a book out, and we sit together, and pretty much most people, that's just where the bathroom is, but sometimes their friend will buy my book or my friend will come and buy their book. And the only other time that I've found book signings to be extremely successful is if I do a school visit during the day, and then that school has a book night at like a Barnes & Noble,
mm-hmm.
and then I go and sign the books there, and then the book signings are very successful.
Oh, that sounds great. Oh, well, thank you for both areas.
Oh, thank you.
For
your questions.
And I'm going to email when I send you the links that she's offered. I wrote an article on how to do a successful book signing, so I'll email you all the link. I think it's actually on the Bookshelf Muses, Angela Ackerman's site. So I'll email you the link, which will help you take some of the anxiety off of book signings. And I love your suggestion, Donna, to link it to a school visit, because there you've got your built-in audience.
Exactly.
That helps a ton. Now, did you have another question, Lori, or did someone else?
No, I'm all set. Thank you. Somebody else.
So,
I have a question.
Go ahead. Oh, so do I.
I'll wait.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, hi. So, Lori Juhas, Donna, it's been an absolute pleasure listening to what you've had to say. A lot of great insight, and congratulations on all your success. So along the path to your success, you talked about your writing process and how very ugly it was, and I think a lot of us can relate to that. Can you share your experience getting through the difficult times and getting through the writer's block. Okay, what is your name? Lori. Okay, hi. So, I'm getting feedback here.
Yeah, we're getting a little bit of feedback. So if you are not talking, go ahead and mute yourself by pushing star 6, and that should help. Go ahead.
Okay, so for the difficult times, when either I can't come up with anything or everything I come up with is not working, first of all, I feel very sorry for my family because I am just miserable to live with during that time. I'm sure that I am in the wrong field and I am just unbearable. How I get out of it, sometimes I give myself a break. I go and watch a movie. I go to a museum. I take a long walk with a friend. Sometimes I just need a break. And sometimes I just push through. And I will say something like, I'm going to sit here and write for 2 hours. I don't care if I just scrawl titles, ideas, words, and I will sit there for the 2 hours. And on one of those sessions that I did that, when nothing was coming, at 1 hour and 59 minutes, I scrawled Olivia Bean Trivia Queen because I thought it was clever and catchy. By the next day, I had the beginning of my book. So you never know. Sometimes you need to know when to walk away. And sometimes you need to know when to plow through, and only you know when that is.
I love that story. That's just such a good one. How you sat down and at, what is it, 1 hour and 59?
Yes, 1 hour and 59 minutes. Out came the title of my book.
That's great. Someone else had a question. I heard you pop in earlier.
Hi, I did. It's Jane Warren calling from Europe, of all places.
Oh, hello.
Hello, I'm in the Netherlands. I have a question about the Eleanor and Park phenomena. I just finished reading it. I don't get a lot of North American books. I have to work hard to find out what's hot and what's not. But it was a great voice-driven novel, but I was surprised about the time setting, and I was surprised that it seemed to be doing as well as it did for teen readers. Is this unique, the time setting? Is it risky?
Eleanor and Park was set in the 1980s, correct?
Yeah, 86, I think, yeah.
Yeah, 86, which was kind of fun for me to read because that time period had relevance. Of course, in today's young readers, they weren't even born then. But I think the phenomenon of Eleanor and Park doing so well is two things. Number one, we got so deeply into the head and heart of this character. And she was quirky. She was very different. She stood out from others. And then the second part, the reason I think the book did so well, is she was always in jeopardy. She had a situation at home. She had a very unpleasant home life. She had a situation at home where she was always in jeopardy. So I think the young reader keeps reading because we have to find out if she's going to be okay.
Yeah, fair enough. I agree. Have you seen it before? Again, I'm at a bit of a deficit because I don't get all the same books you do. Is it a time setting that is really unusual now in the States?
No, I really have not seen a lot of books set in the 1980s, and I think that made it a little bit different. Just that right there, I think, made it a little bit different.
Thanks. Appreciate your insights. It was a great book.
Oh, thank you.
Muting now. Sorry, guys.
Great question, and now I'm going to have to go read this book. I'm very excited. I've been seeing it everywhere, every time I go into my indie bookstore. We have time for one more question. Does anybody have a question?
I'd like to jump in as a consumer. This is Beth Hoffman in Waukesha, Wisconsin. We have what's called Freeman Friday Night Live in Waukesha during the summer. And our Martha Merrill's bookstore frequently has authors sitting outside the store while musicians are performing. And I have a half shelf of books that I bought just last year. And I have not read all of them, but I have read at least one and commented to the author, and that got me the job of proofreading her next book. So
wow.
That her publisher didn't let slip through some of the things that I caught before the publisher got it. Because I had found some things that the publisher did slip through in the previous book.
That's pretty amazing.
Thank you. I would very much like to be able to catch the things before the publisher has an opportunity to let them slip through. And I did get a hint from last month's mastermind class about where to go to look for that kind of publishers. Haven't gone to the publishers yet, but I did find the list.
Yeah, thank you for that. I think that's wonderful. What I would suggest, and I love those outdoor readings and anything to do with the indie bookstores and authors, but what I would suggest is definitely contacting publishers, because they hire freelance proofreaders. And you might also want to make yourself available for independent authors who are looking for proofreaders before they publish their book. So I think there's a lot of need for what you seem to be very good at doing.
Thank you. I would very much like to fill that need.
Thanks, Beth.
Thanks, Beth.
Thank you.
Donna, do you have a final piece of wisdom or advice to give us to send us on our way?
Just one. Let's think. There's so much involved in this. I've been doing this for so many years. I've been published for over 20 years, and I still learn something new all the time. There's just so much to learn. But one thing that I think I would leave everybody with is simply this: finish what you start. If you have an idea for a great book and you're partway through and another shiny idea kind of comes your way, write it down, put it aside, and finish what you started, because I think that's the number one impediment to people getting published. It gets hard. It gets ugly. It's like when you're running a marathon and you hit the wall. It's like that when you're writing a book. It's like that when you're revising a book. Just keep plowing through to the end, because the only way that your book will get into young readers' hands is if you finish what you start. And the author Meg Cabot did a great video on her website about that very thing. It was very funny. But I think it's very, very valid advice. Don't chase the shiny new idea, because they're always going to seem wonderful. Dig in and do the hard work of the idea that you're working on.
That is great advice. I love it. Thank you, Donna. It's been such a treat to have you with us, and you've given us so much wisdom today. I really appreciate it. Listeners, I want to remind you that Donna's website is donnagephart.com, Donna, GEPHART.com, and you can connect with her there. If you want to have a chance to win her book, you can go to my website, rightnowcoach.com/blog, find Donna's wonderful blog post on Calm, and do a comment or whatever you have to do to enter to win. I think the drawing is tomorrow at midnight or whatever, but we'll make sure that we do the drawing. So enter, and then about Friday I'll send out a link to the recording along with Donna's recommendations, and I'll have a list with links from her on Friday. So thanks, everybody. It's been lovely to have you with us. This is Rochelle, the Right Now Coach. You've been at the Right Now Mastermind class, and I hope you'll visit us next month. Thanks so much. Have a great day, and keep writing. Bye-bye.